Welcome to Political Point of View on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM. In this program, we talk with politicians of all types, of all sorts, from local government through to central government, and including aspiring candidates. Sit back and enjoy.
Hello, listeners. Today is another day of A Political Point of View with Graham Priest, and today's guest is Simon Court, who, of course, is an ACT MP from Auckland. Simon, you wanted to chat today about Transmission Gully. What would you like to tell us?
Well, I hope that everybody who can has had a chance to drive on the Transmission Gully Highway.
It's brilliant.
And it is brilliant. And really appreciate what good infrastructure, what good transport connections look like. Because for so long, parts of New Zealand like Wellington have not had the opportunity to benefit from new transportation infrastructure. And there's been a sense that under successive governments that projects that are announced are then second-guessed by an incoming government, or there's a change of government policy. Projects get cancelled and budgets get reallocated. And we've seen that around the country with road transportation projects primarily. And today, of course, we've heard that Let's Get Wellington Moving has been announced again, but without an option for private vehicles. But just thinking about Transmission Gully, it's cost over $1 billion, but it's actually delivered some fantastic benefits to the region. And I personally think, and ACT believes, that if we agreed on 30-year infrastructure programs between central and local government, the regions like Porirua and Kapiti and the Hutt Valley and Wellington, who have all benefited from Transmission Gully, and actually go ahead and they can't be tipped over by incoming governments. We think we've seen 5 years of delay, wasted expenses on, and that's even wasted expenses on things like the bike bridge in Auckland and Let's Get Wellington Moving. Spent over $50 million on consulting fees, and all they've managed to do is take out some parking and reduce speed limits. So we actually think a better way forward is to set up a long-term partnership between the regions who know where stuff needs to get built and central government who's got a role in funding it, and then let them get on with it. And politicians should never, ever be announcing projects, by the way, Graham.
Right. Well, that, to me, is absolutely common sense, and it was a subject that, for some peculiar reason, is actually on my list of questions for you today. The projection for the population growth from Plymouth to Levin in 30 years is some 150,000 people. Now, that's a fairly reasonable size metropolitan area, and it's patently obvious that the current rail system is going to be nowhere able to cope. And this was, funnily enough, in the Dom Post that I read this morning, that they are looking at 200,000 extra people in 30 years' time in the Wellington region that has got to be serviced. And currently, the rail system is pretty well at bursting point, simply because the infrastructure is basically stuffed and inadequate, and the rolling stock is inadequate. Plus, the signalling system was built, I think, in something like about 1960-odd, and it's so far past its used-by date, it's not even funny, and it's totally unreliable. So it's a pleasure to hear somebody saying that you've got to be looking 30 years out.
Yeah, and Graham, you make a really important point. These growth predictions, while they sound almost fantastical,
they're not fantastical.
You know, 100,000 or 150,000 or 200,000 people coming to live in my city, that the farmland or the paddocks that I drive past now on the way out of town, will 50,000 people live there? Well, look, I mean, we only have to look at towns like Tauranga Hamilton, and of course Auckland, where I'm from, to say, well, that's probably on the medium side. Your growth could even be larger. We're only 5 million people here in New Zealand, and what we've learned in the past 2 years, despite the government's insistence that we don't need immigrants, is actually we need people to come and live in New Zealand so that and have families and bring families so that we can grow. And when cities grow, you can deliver much better services to people, whether it's better schools and hospitals, as well as better social outcomes. And so, look, if we're going to invest in places that people are going to live, we have to deliver the transportation connections between those communities first. That's what they do in places like Australia, who knew, and the US, even Europe. So if you think about what the Infrastructure Commission said in their recent infrastructure strategy document that they proposed to the government, and Minister Grant Robertson, he has to respond in terms of the legislation around infrastructure, respond to the Infrastructure Commission in the next few months. What the Commission has said is that we need to focus on doing more with the infrastructure we've got, and that large flagship projects, essentially what I would call political vanity projects, are a massive distraction from actually delivering the basic services that we need so that we can have healthy communities and a thriving economy. And you make the point about the rail line. Now, if they've spent $50 million odd dollars just on consulting about a project called Let's Get Wellington Moving, imagine what you could have done with $50 million to upgrade the signals and to invest in stations and to start planning, designating and acquiring land for expanding that corridor, which will certainly need to be expanded at some point in the future. That's where you see the 30-year infrastructure plan actually leading you to a much better place for communities that we know are going to grow, but rather than choking off the development or making the development much more expensive, we invest in the infrastructure, build on the corridors we've already got. And I think you've hit the nail on the head there.
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting. I had to drive back from Wellington on late at night on Sunday, and I didn't pass one vehicle going from Pukerua Bay to Paikokoriki, but as soon as I hit the expressway, there was a continual line of trucks heading south into Wellington, and I assume it would be for a late-night ferry or making major deliveries. But previously, all that traffic, that heavy road traffic, trucks would have been trundling along that congested seafront. Now, the gully has made an enormous difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we can think about investment in transportation projects as being investment in communities, primarily, rather than this current government's dissembling approach about climate change. I mean, if they say that we need to shift everyone onto buses and trains because of climate change, I would say that's actually not the right case to make. The case that you've just made, actually 200,000 odd people are going to be living in that strip north of Wellington, that's the case for investment in public transport and transportation overall, which includes roads. And I could give you an example. I mean, Otaki is going to benefit from that. And I know that people are already imagining what, say, Otaki as a township looks like and live in once the state highway bypasses those towns. But I'll give you the example of a little village north of Auckland called Orewa Beach. Now, when I was working as a civil engineer in earthworks back in the 1990s, the township of Orewa, which is a white sandy beach just north of Auckland, a lovely little township.
It's a very attractive place.
Very attractive place. But there was a stream, constant stream of truck and trailers running between the fish and chip shop and the beach that you had to duck and dodge between with your surfboard or your skateboard because that was State Highway 1. And when the new motorway extensions north of Auckland were delivered in the early 2000s, Orewa could suddenly become the community that always had the potential to be, a lovely beachside community which is now a destination for people to travel to from other parts of the region on the weekends to have lunch in a cafe or to stroll along the promenade. You couldn't do that when you had 15,000 heavy vehicles a day running through the township. And so we need to think about investment in transportation, and that includes roads, as actually investment in our communities.
Yes, well, there's a large number of heavy trucks still trundling through the middle of Levin, which makes it very difficult to get across the road there as well. And everything gets covered in black diesel soot, which is pretty darn unpleasant.
Yeah, pretty hard to enjoy your soy latte out there on the footpath at a cafe with heavy trucks running past every 15 or 20 seconds, Graham.
Yeah, well, eventually there is going to be a road that bypasses, but goodness knows when that's ever going to happen.
Right.
There seems to be a lot of woolly thinking about where it's going and all the rest of it. And the population of Levin in 25 years is supposed to grow in excess of 20,000. So it's going to become a substantial provincial town with a population of probably in excess of 50,000.
Well, that's right. And once the highway moves away, once it's realigned away from the main street, then that town will flourish. You know, new businesses will open up. People will want to stop and shop. And a town will flourish there that currently can't because it's got State Highway 1 running through the middle of it. Well, if you mentioned the time frames and the uncertainty, and that's really, really tough because the uncertainty is caused not just by governments wanting to change policies and build bike bridges over Auckland Harbour or shut the Victoria Park Tunnel and only the Mount Vic Tunnel and only let walking and cycling through it. It's actually about funding because if there was more money, then we could build more stuff and we wouldn't have to have this binary choice between either you're allowed a bus or a bike or you're allowed a road for a car, but you can't have both. Well, actually, if we look at other models of funding infrastructure from around the world, there is $300 billion of private capital that was invested in public infrastructure in the year before COVID-19 struck. Now, things have changed a little bit, but there's a heck of a lot of money out there. International investors are keen to invest. I speak to them on a regular basis who say if there was a government open to it, we would love to invest in transportation, schools, hospitals even, on a public-private partnership basis. There are literally hundreds of billions of dollars looking for secure long-term investments in countries like New Zealand, which are stable, where we have an economy that produces food for 40 million people. We can pay our bills. We can pay stuff off, just like having a mortgage on your house. And if we were to do that, then actually we could have projects like the Levin Bypass delivered decades ahead of when a government or a transport agency thinks they'll be able to pay for it.
Well, I've been discussing this very thing with some of our local politicians, and if you look at an extra 30,000 people in Kapiti, that's another 6 primary schools and it's another 2 secondary schools. And it's definitely going to need a hospital, and yet there has been no purchases of land made for that purpose. So where on earth are you going to put these things if they're not planned for? And Levin's going to need another, 4 primary schools and another secondary school and possibly some form of hospital. And yet there's no provision being made by central government. They're wanting to intensify land use and increase the number of people living by the corridors, but we still have to make use for those other facilities, and it ain't happening.
That's right. Well, we have taken an extremely short-term approach to investment in social infrastructure in New Zealand, because you don't build a road or you don't build something just because you like pouring concrete. I mean, I do like pouring concrete, Graham, and I, I like watching asphalt get laid, but that's not why we build this stuff.
Probably in your bloodstream.
That's right. We do. We build it because they build infrastructure, whether it's a transport or a hospital or a school or a wastewater treatment plant. They deliver social benefits. And so, actually, that's what we should be focusing on. But a three-year electoral cycle and a 1 to 3 year funding cycle makes it impossible for organisations, whether it's your district health board, which won't exist after Friday, but that's another story for another day, your district health board or your Ministry of Education say, well, we know we've got funding for the next year because it's in the budget that's put up by the Minister of Finance. We know that we've got a three-year window of funding, but if we need to build a new hospital 8 years from now, we can't start planning that because we don't know if we'll have the funding to do it. And so then everything comes back to, well, what can we do in 1 year that actually gets a few runs on the board, and what can we do within 3 years that gets our project a little bit further ahead? Well, actually, you'd say, if you're going to have another 50,000 people living here 15 or 20 years from now, you'd want to be buying the land, as you said, getting all the designs up, and actually going out to contractors and saying, this project's coming up in the next 5 to 8 years, what would you need to know in order to be ready to bid for it so that we get competitive prices? Because at the moment, everything's a surprise. It's a surprise to contractors when a government department puts out a contract for procurement, because they're like, well, we kind of knew it was coming, but we didn't know when you'd get approvals or when it was going to land. So we're doing some other stuff at the moment. We can bid on it, but we won't be able to start till next year. And by the way, because we're taking resources and so on from other projects, it's going to cost a bit more. And that's if we can get the materials, and we'll let you know what it costs when we're about halfway through the project. Mm. Well, that's just unacceptable. The Infrastructure Commission says we need to get much better at it. And I've outlined ACT strategy, ACT plan, which is the 30-year infrastructure partnerships between central and local government. And we need to reform the Public Finance Act as well, as I've mentioned, that act which limits investment horizons to 3 years. And so there's a whole lot of good stuff we can do, and that's what ACT thinks about. That's what our MPs think about all the time. And, you know, happy to share more with you, Graham, but I'll very quickly get into the public policy weeds, which isn't necessarily that interesting to your listeners.
Yeah, well, currently planning and speed seems to me to be backside first. however, that's my opinion. What lessons can we learn from Transmission Gully?
Well, firstly, let's start with what we've just learned, that the opening ceremony cost $337,000.
Simon, that's absolutely obscene from a taxpayer point of view.
Yeah, that could have delivered about 3 kilometres of asphalt on local roads or state highways. And you'd have to say that if all of these opening ceremonies are simply designed for ministers and prime ministers to come and cut a ribbon and everything revolves around them, we should just do away with them. The only opening ceremony that the public wants is for the road for the cones to be removed and the road to be open.
That's so, right. There's a debacle currently in Waikato, isn't there?
Yeah, well, that's right. And, you know, I've heard from people who work in government departments who are horrified at the waste, that the number of emails and phone calls and rearranging diaries so that a minister can attend an opening, whether it's of a school or a road, is outrageous. It's costing the taxpayer a phenomenal amount of money. And if the taxpayers spend hundreds of millions of dollars on a new asset, like a four-lane highway at 110 kilometres an hour speed limit, then they should be able to use it. And if the minister wants to come along and get a photo op from an overbridge, they can arrange that on any day. So I think what we've learned from Transmission Gully is focus on delivering the project, focus on helping the designer and the contractor overcome regulatory barriers like, you know, resource consenting. I don't know if I've described this to you, but I understand on Transmission Gully, they wanted to improve drainage by installing larger culverts and drain pipes. Well, the regional council said, oh, you can't do that. That's different from the design. You're going to have to apply for new consent. Well, the designer said, we're making it better. They said, no, new consent. And that's not month and hundreds of thousands of dollars to resolve in technical reports and toing and froing. So you have to say, what have we learned from transmission gully? Don't waste a cent on an opening ceremony, just let people drive on it. And the role of government, the role of government agencies should be to knock over all of the barriers and remove all the red tape so stuff just get built faster and delivered sooner so we can use it.
So what's the problem with the hold-up in Waikato for the opening there?
We don't know what the hold-up is, but I can only imagine that it revolves around the opening ceremony and the desire of a minister and potentially other regional leaders to have a pair of scissors in their hand and to be cutting a ribbon and to get a photo opportunity. Because once a project has received practical completion, in other words, the engineer responsible for signing off the project is complete, once he's issued the practical completion certificate to the contractor, then that means that the client, in this case the transport agency, has received their new asset and it's ready to use.
And well, it should start rolling.
That's right. It doesn't mean that that a few defects, maybe a bit of paint's chipped, or you know, there's a bit of planting still to do. That's not material to whether the road can be used. And we also learned that from Transmission Gully, that it looked like practical completion was actually achieved as far back, potentially as November, December 2021, and yet the transport agency had its own idea about what completion should look like. So these things aren't anywhere near as complicated as government ministers make out they are. They're actually very simple. When the road is complete, then it's ready to use, and we shouldn't have to wait for opening ceremonies in order for the public to be able to use this asset that they've paid for.
It's music to taxpayers' ears. Three Waters, how's that getting on?
Well, it's not going too well if you live in a small town or a community where your council hasn't invested in maintaining your water infrastructure, or you live in a town like Tauranga or Auckland, where I do, where housing growth has far outstripped the ability of the existing network to cope. And so where I live in West Auckland, I live near what's called the Henderson Creek. It was one of the first places to be developed in West Auckland. People sailed sailing ships up there and took the timber out of the Waitakere Ranges. But the Henderson Creek's actually a fantastic environment to kayak in. We've got a water ski club, we've got a rowing club and a sailing club. And yet, literally metres from the boat ramp and the dock is a wastewater manhole that's called an engineered overflow point. And after just a moderate amount of rain, that overflows raw sewage metres from where we launch our boats. And there is no current plan to fix that because that's a $1 billion problem to fix. That wastewater pipe takes all the sewage from the North Shore and northwest of Auckland, and it's going to cost $1 billion to build a big wastewater tunnel to stop those overflows. So in terms of how Three Waters going, well, the water's not getting any cleaner any faster, but what the government has done, they've put a bill into the House just a few weeks ago, which is I would ask your listeners to make a submission on. It's called the Water Services Entities Bill. And what it does, it sets up a co-governance structure where it takes the water assets out of the control of local government, who actually, if they had more funding, and as we described, a 30-year infrastructure plan agreed with central government, in other words, stuff to do, and you get the money when you do it, we wouldn't need any of this Three Water stuff. But if we come back to the problem of co-governance, and that's a problem that Minister Nanaia Mahuta and this Labor government have created for themselves, and they've said, look, public assets. There's an issue that Māori, they believe, have rights and interests in fresh water. And we say, and that means we need to give them the wastewater treatment plant and the drinking water, and they can have co-governance over it. They can appoint 50% of the people to the representation group from iwi Māori, which we know would all be the same people who sit on all the other boards. They'd be directors, they'd be knights and dames and sirs and lords. They wouldn't necessarily be people who had water experience. But if we look at why the government, why the minister might think that she needs to allocate co-governance over our water assets to iwi Māori groups, you have to say it wasn't that long ago that councils, when they went to build a new wastewater treatment plant, like in Auckland, where I live, on the Manukau Harbour near the airport, they built the oxidation ponds right in front of the marae and over the mudflats where local communities collect the shellfish. That's an appalling way to treat the Māori people who live there and that community. And you'd say the same with rubbish tips. How come councils for years and years built the rubbish tip in the estuary, and often that was a place where people had customarily collected shellfish and fish? All of those things affected Māori communities in an uneven way compared to the rest of us. And then you'd say, well, what about this rights and interest in fresh water? Well, actually, there's a case right now before the Waitangi Tribunal where Ngāi Tahu, a South Island iwi, had made a claim that, well, they were the first people to sell water. They sold it to some French sailors back in the 1800s. They said, if you want to top up your tanks, it's going to cost you a gold coin. The French paid, and so Ngāi Tahu said, look, that proves it. We've got rights and interests, property rights in water. But the government doesn't want to deal with that. Instead, it's essentially patching over all the councils with their co-governance model. They want to handpick and appoint people, and Minister Mahuta's got a few problems with who's getting handpicked and appointed. At the moment, she hasn't justified how people she knows have ended up on all these panels.
Well, it's even worse than that. There's assistants on the CEO, I believe.
And look, you know, this is a small country, and different family members will end up doing different stuff in different parts of government and public organisations. So I don't have a problem with that. The ACT Party doesn't have a problem with that, as long as conflicts of interest are appropriately managed and the people who have those roles are appropriate. I think that's the problem with the co-governance model around Three Waters. It's not clear that the people who would be appointed to the co-governance boards, remember there's three layers, there's regional advisory co-governance board, and then there's the regional representation group for each water entity, and that's another co-governance board, 50-50 appointment, iwi Māori and local representatives, and then they pick the actual board that governs the water corporation. And we say there's just so much opportunity for red tape, for bureaucracy, conflicting objectives, and really, what kind of country do we live in where we have a government, the Labour Party in government, who believes that allocating rights based on your ethnicity and your race is an appropriate way to make decisions about things as important public assets as drinking water and wastewater? Mm. It's just completely inappropriate, and it's a very dark path to go down. And the ACT Party would never, ever support co-governance measures over public assets. Mm. Quite different for resource management decision-making, where, as I pointed out in the past, many iwi, more primarily hapū and whānau, have had their rights trampled on by local government and other government agencies building roads right through the marae, through Māori land, or building a wastewater treatment plant right on the mudflats in front of where they get a shellfish at MRI. So they're two completely different problems that won't be solved by co-government.
Okay, just the last minute. One, I noticed in this morning's paper that fullers are going to be forced to go into the regional authority transport scheme. What would you comment about that?
Fuller's ferry business has operated in Auckland for a very long time. They're owned privately. They're actually owned by a guy who lives in Scotland who has made massive investments in the ferry services in Auckland. They've trained hundreds and hundreds of people who've come off the street and onto a boat as a deckhand, and after 3 or 4 years can become a master of their own vessel. They're actually a business which is invested in Auckland in a way that it's hard to compare who else has done this. You'd say, look, fullers know what they're doing out there on Auckland Harbour. They know what stuff costs. And when they say our diesel cost has doubled in the past 12 months and that's why we're putting up fares, why on earth would that be an excuse for government and Auckland Council to patch over their business and saying, well, we're not going to let you operate unless you sign up to our public transport contract. And by the way, then we set the fares. Well,
Not only that, they've got to re-tendered every so many years.
Yeah, and look, what they've said is they're happy to compete with whoever else wants to come into the market. But actually, what government and council should be doing is setting the rules of the game rather than, as the current government's doing, investing and buying its own electric ferries and giving them to Auckland Transport to compete against Fullers. I mean, I talked to the Fullers guys a few weeks ago. They said that they offered to buy the ferries and run them. All they wanted was an operating contract. And yet we've got the government stepping in with $20-plus million of taxpayer money saying that they're going to buy the ferries and get to say who operates them. So I just think if we want better public transport, if we want better connections, including on the water, we've actually got to listen to the people who deliver the services, who build the buses, coaches and ferries. They know what they're doing. They've been doing it for decades in New Zealand. And it's about time we listened.
Okay, Simon, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. This has been another session of A Political Point of View with Graham Priest and today's guest, Simon Court, ACT MP. Thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Political Point of View on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM. In this program, we've talked with politicians of all types, of all sorts, from local government through to central government and including aspiring candidates.
This program is made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.